am very excited to be interviewing Ontario NDP leader Andrea Horvath. Now, full disclosure, everybody, I am a federal Liberal. I have voted Liberal for as long as I have been able to vote at the federal level, but I've always been a swing voter in every provincial election that I've been here in Ontario. I've voted for John Tory's party, I've voted for the Ontario Liberals, and I have voted in 2014, and now I'm going to do it again in 2018 for the Ontario NDP. And the reason why is because Andrea Horvath, to me, is a real inspiration. She's a child of an immigrant father from Slovakia who built his family and so provided for his family along with his wife by working for the Ford Motor Company. She's from Hamilton, the industrial heartland, really, of our province. And she's like us. She's working class. She understands what's going on around the kitchen tables of the province and in the living rooms of the province, in the schools of the province. And she's a single mom. And as a child of a single mom, that's a big deal to me. So being able to sit down with the wonderful Andrea Horvath, who has been a member of the provincial parliament since 2004, when she was elected in Hamilton and then became leader of the Ontario New Democrats in 2009. Well, it's an exceptional privilege for me. We have very few leaders that are willing to defend the courage of their conviction and demand better from our population. But Andrea Horvath is exactly one of those people. So I encourage you to listen to the full interview. Go and check out OntarioNDP.ca and give them your vote this election, because what she represents is change for the better. And I truly mean that. I'm not saying that to gush. I'm not saying that for any other reason than there are a lot of Liberal voters there, like myself, at the federal level, who expect better from our healthcare system, from our social safety net, from our fiscal situation, our hydro situation, whatever the case may be. We want better, and we want better infrastructure. Doug Ford's not the way to go, folks. This wonderful leader and her party are, and in this election, I encourage you to vote for them. In the meantime, though, hear this interview with Andrea Horvath. It's coming to you from her bus when she was traveling down from Sudbury back to Toronto. Does cut out a couple times, but it doesn't cut out any aspect of her message and how important it is. So enjoy the interview.
A lot of people have become very cynical about politics and politicians. They see what's happening currently in Ontario. Just deep sense of disappointment. It absolutely does not have to be this way. I really believe that there are decisions that governments can make that will make it easier for people to have a good life. I think Ontario should be a province where people can build a good life. Is that too much to expect? I don't think so.
Well, I am delighted to welcome to the pod my favorite political leader in Ontario, Andrea Horvath. Democratic.
Well, that is a lovely...
The leader of the new Democratic Sorry. Party of Ontario. No, it's fine. Welcome to the pod.
I was surprised that you would, that you would say that. And I very deeply appreciate it. That's lovely. Thank you.
Hey, listen, us progressives, we have to stick together. I'm a federal Liberal, but I got to say, you've got me voting NDP in 2014 and now again in 2018. So huge welcome to the pod.
Oh, thanks, Cameron. I'm glad to be able to spend some time with you.
So talk to me a little bit about where you're at right now. You had an announcement on hydro this morning in Sudbury. Now, where are you off to?
Well, we came from Sudbury, drove along the wonderful highways of the north and stopped in Orillia and had a nice crowd there with our candidate, Elizabeth Van Hoot. And then we've just come from Barrie, and I have to tell you, we were expecting 20 or 30 folks in a little cafe, and as our bus pulled up, there were over 100 people with signs and cheering, and it was nice. Quite the warm welcome in Barrie. So we're just leaving there and heading back to Toronto.
Nice. Well, let's talk about your announcement today about hydro. So people are suffering. You know that. You've been raising this in the legislature for years. The Liberals went ahead with privatizing a good chunk of hydro. You want to buy it back. Now, a lot of people ask, well, how does that make it more affordable? What was it about your announcement today that you think is going to be most important to the folks, the families that are going to be voting on June 7th?
Well, I mean, we have some immediate initiatives that will bring the bills down. The first and foremost is we will end mandatory time of use pricing so that people aren't punished for cooking dinner at dinner time. We're also going to get rid of the unfair delivery charges that are different from people in rural Ontario versus people in urban centers. We're going to bring it down to the urban rate for everyone. We're also going to do some hard work to get rid of the excess capacity that we have, the excess generation that we basically practically give away for free.
Yep.
And we pay a pretty penny to generate that electricity. So we're going to get rid of as much of the excess as possible. And we're going to have to keep a little bit of excess. And so we'll just make sure that when we sell that excess power, we'll do it in a way that's financially beneficial to Ontarians with longer term contracts. Other jurisdictions do that. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that. But the most important thing, and it goes to the heart of why people are so disappointed with Kathleen Wynne and the Liberals, and that's that people didn't want our public electricity system to fall into private hands.
You're right.
They know that it's the best thing for Ontario families, for businesses, for industry is to control our own electricity system, and it also helps us with environmental initiatives and getting some ability to ensure that we have programs that help people reduce their carbon footprint. I mean, having the ability to utilize that utility to help people reduce their consumption of electricity is extremely important. So for all kinds of reasons, it was the wrong thing to do. Most importantly, though, for over 100 years, electricity was provided in an affordable way and a reliable way to Ontarians. And we firmly believe, unlike Kathleen Wynne and unlike Doug Ford, that we need to put that utility back in public hands. And it's going to take us some time to do that. And we realize it. We know it's going to take us a little bit of time. But that won't only help us to keep the rates down over the longer run. But it also, it also is about leaving the next generation with an ability to do that, for their families in the future. It's one of those building blocks for the future. And I hear it all the time, Cameron, from people. Like, folks are not only worried about their own situation. Like, people are finding it, tough to make ends meet. And, young people are having a hard time finding decent work. And people are working the gig economy, lots of casual,
right,
part-time contracts, all that stuff. But the other big concern people have that I hear is for the next generation. So not only do we have to put things in order for for us, but we have an obligation and a responsibility to do that for the next generation as well. So that's another piece of why we think making this effort, and it's going to be an effort to get Hydro One back into public hands is worthwhile. It's worth doing.
Well, I know I sure wasn't asked, and neither were the voters of Ontario when it went to privatization. So I thank you for wanting to fight for it. But I guess one of the things I do want to ask you too is, we know that there was a lot of degrading over time, over a lot of governments, regardless of stripe, of our infrastructure grid, our electrical grid, our infrastructure for hydro in the province. But your plan, it does address those gaps. It does continue to make investments to ensure that we've got the best in North America.
Absolutely, absolutely, it does. The other piece that we are bringing to the infrastructure puzzle, and whether it's the electricity system or whether it's transit or whether it's housing, is that we're looking at provision of infrastructure in a way that is a lot more cost responsible. And I say that because we've seen a report from the Auditor General that has said that infrastructure in Ontario has cost us about $8 billion more than necessary because of the financing model that the Conservatives and Liberals favor. And we want to cut out the profiteers in the infrastructure game and make sure that we're providing infrastructure. Again, it's public money, and it should be invested in the public interest. And so the P3 model is not something we favor. We want every single public dollar to build public infrastructure for the benefit of the public and for the benefit of the economy.
Awesome. Well, let me just, while you're still coming out of Northern Ontario, I want to raise something. It's different, obviously, from hydro, but I want to talk a little bit about what Doug Ford said yesterday during the leaders debate, because I thought it was really, a pretty vile comment when he said that we need to take care of our own in this province before we start bringing in immigrants to fill jobs up in Northern Ontario. Now, we know that the Northern Ontario economy is can and is a real driver of the Ontario economy writ large, but it continues to, for a variety of reasons, people continue to move south, mostly because their higher paying jobs are moving down there. But what do you say to folks like Doug Ford and others who have this knee-jerk reaction that having immigrants in Northern Ontario or anywhere else is somehow a net loss for our province?
Well, you know, it was really shocking to hear those comments, and I've been asked about it, as I'm sure you can imagine. And so I think about it in two ways. I mean, first and foremost, usually when we hear comments like that, what people are really saying is that they are against newcomers, and
right.
they don't think that newcomers belong in our communities. So that's the first piece that was really quite disturbing when I heard that comment yesterday. The other thing, though, is that the question that was being asked was being asked because exactly what you described, because northern communities need an influx of population. They need people with some skills. They need people who are, you know, prepared to help them rebuild communities that have been shrinking because of the you know, the migration, if you will, or the movement of particularly young people to urban centers for more opportunity. And so it just seemed odd to me that the very question that was being asked is, will you help us by helping us to facilitate more newcomers to come into our communities? And yet the way he answered it was just, it was so opposite to what the message was that the municipalities of the North were getting at, you know. So I couldn't understand on either level what was going on, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't think most people understand what's going on when Doug Ford opens his mouth. But, you know, I worry about the coarsening of debate and coarsening of this. I guess I worry about this degrading of debate when it comes to immigrants and immigration. We've seen it south of the border. And I know one of the things that I asked my listeners is to send me a question or two just to ask you. And one of the ones that was raised was one about your plan to have a sanctuary, Ontario designated a sanctuary province. But I know that folks like Doug Ford like to kind of, you know, flog that bush, as it were, to try and scare people. So how would you explain that policy? How would you explain why this is so important for our province?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's true about Ontario and Canada is that except for the First Nations communities, we have a shrinking population. Our population is shrinking. We do have a growing population when it comes to Indigenous and First Nations communities, which is wonderful. But overall, if we don't have, immigration to our country and to our province, that won't be sustainable. I mean, we can't sustain, our economy. We can't sustain our communities. We need immigration to be able to grow. And anybody who is who's kind of not aware of that and wants to actually take the premier's chair, that's pretty worrisome. And so when we talk about a sanctuary province, I mean, that came out of course, what was happening south of the border, right? What we saw, what Donald Trump was doing and trying to literally, you know, round up people that he felt didn't belong in America from various jurisdictions and tell them that they had to, you know, they had to get out. And what we're saying is the opposite. I mean, we welcome people from around the world. And you know what? We used to say that, you know, particularly the city of Toronto was, you know, one of the most diverse cities in the world. And it is. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
But now pretty much everywhere I go in Ontario, you know, there's a reflection of the benefits of immigration and the the richness of diversity in many parts of Ontario. And I think that will only help us to become a stronger and more successful province.
Well, and frankly, we're all descended from immigrants. Immigrants built this country. Your own father from Hungary.
True that, yes.
You know, worked in the Ford Motor Company.
Yes, Slovakia. He was from Slovakia, but he's German. So they were ethnic German, but from Slovakia. And he immigrated from Slovakia after the war. He spoke with an accent, quite a thick accent. And you're right. Yeah, he was a auto worker. He worked at Ford Motor Company. I, you know, grew up in a working class family, and you know that shaped a lot of who I am. Because you know, when I think about it, he had four kids, and he was able to build a good life for our family. I mean, we didn't you know, we didn't go on lavish trips every year, but we did the northern camping trips and things like that. We got to Florida once by car, which was fun. I won't tell you some of the scary details about that trip. I think it traumatized both of my brothers, but that's another story. the bottom line is that those kinds of jobs aren't as prevalent anymore, you know, and it's getting back to talking about why the platform is the way it is. And it's because we do have a changing economy and people don't have jobs that they keep for long periods of time, and they don't have benefits and they don't have their prescription drugs, paid for, and they can't get dental care. And, you know, we have to acknowledge that and decide as a province that that's not good enough in the year 2018, that people should be able to get pain in their mouth dealt with. You know, folks shouldn't have to go to an emergency ward to get painkillers because they have pain in their mouth, right? I mean, I met a 24-year-old young woman in Sarnia recently, and she was literally trying to decide whether she should take a pair of pliers and pull out her own tooth because she couldn't go to the dentist and get the abscess dealt with.
So
that
let's
shouldn't
talk.
Be happening.
No, it shouldn't be happening. So let's talk about that platform. $12 a day daycare. Free child care for those making $40,000 and under, free dental care that you've admitted, investments in mental health, ending hallway medicine, which I think everybody can agree to, investing billions of dollars in capital upgrades to our hospital facilities and our medical facilities across the province. How much of you spoke a little bit about your family. How much of your own experience as a parent? You're a single mom. I'm a child of a single mom. I think my mom is tough as nails, and I have no doubt that you are as well. But how much of your own experience, not only as a parent, but from a working class family, Hamilton, has informed the building of your platform? Like what is bringing Hamilton values and working class values back to the fore of politics in Ontario mean to you?
Well, I mean, it's a couple of things. I mean, one of them is exactly that. I mean, I've had ups and downs in my career. I mean, I was a waitress for 10 years. I served tables to try to get myself through university, and because my dad, although he could, you know, he could manage to keep the family, with a roof over our heads and food on the table, he didn't have enough money to save to put his kids through university. And in fact, I mean, I went to university because I waitressed for 10 years to get myself through university. And I actually decided the last 2 years I went part-time because I couldn't afford to go full-time. And I know a lot of young people today make those kinds of decisions.
Did you have to take loans, Andrea?
I did. I took loans. Compared to what students have to borrow today, I didn't. They weren't that big. I think I had ended up with about a $6,000 student loan when I finished university, and I think it was 86. But in 86, $6,000 was a lot of money.
And
you know what I mean?
Well, of course. And now what you're proposing, speaking of students, is to actually retroactively apply the interest paid on any outstanding loan to the remaining principal, which is fantastic,
right?
And switching loans to grants.
Because that's exactly right.
So college should be accessible for all.
Absolutely, it should be. It should be. Switching grants to rather loans to grants so that people don't end up having to pay them back. Going forward, anybody that's carrying a loan won't have interest charged in the future. And as you said, anybody who's carrying a loan, say they've finished university or college and they're out in the workforce, we will pay back any interest that you've paid on that outstanding loan for two reasons. One is because there's no way that the government should be profiting off the backs of students who are having a hard time, making a living. I mean, young people are leaving university and college and they're not getting those jobs that set them up for a future immediately, right? They're struggling for a number of years and in many cases, you know, they're into their 30s before they're landing a decent job. So we're saying the government shouldn't be hauling in revenues off the backs of struggling students. So that's why the interest thing is important to me. It's about 20, depending on the year, average is about $25 million. That comes in that revenue stream. That $25 million should stay in the pockets of students. So the other piece is, you know, if you've already gotten your education and you've got a big principal outstanding, this little rebate will help tackle that principal to some extent. And it's all about trying to give students a better chance, or trying to give young people a better chance in an economy that's that's difficult.
Well, one of the things that I love about your platform, and you know, I make no bones on the pod that I'm a huge fan of the Ontario NDP and the Progressives. So, you know, in that regard, I'm happy to make sure that you are able to reach all of our listeners. And we do have quite a few, especially in Ontario. But one of the things that I love about your platform is not only is it finally getting back to the social democratic roots of the party, but you're also addressing the social determinants of health. You know, you're talking about poverty, you're talking about violence, shelter, equity, the environment. But I guess one question I have for you, and it's just generally speaking on that, on the social determinants side, we have a healthcare system in Ontario that has, you know, a lot of good and a lot of potholes that need to be addressed. But one of the things that, you know, I've seen family go through the system in every province, but here in Ontario as well. And one of the things that it struck me is that we have done a very good job in some respects of building a sickness care system in the province, but we've not really done as well in building a wellness model of care. So what aspects of your platform kind of focus on keeping people well for longer periods of time, as opposed to just pumping money into them once they get sick and kind of just running out the clock?
No, that's an excellent point and an excellent question. I just want to take 1 minute to frame this in kind of where I come from. My riding is one of the lowest, I think it's actually the lowest median income in the entire province. There was a report done by a local journalist called Code Red, and it basically says that Hamilton Center, my riding, has the largest amount of lower income families than any other riding in the province. I think the next one is Toronto Center.
Wow.
So Hamilton Center has a lot of poverty, and I've watched as two decades have gone by and things haven't changed under Liberals or Conservatives. And I've watched, you know, in my community, the age expectancy of a male, for example, is like 12 years less than in the higher income ridings next door to mine.
In your riding?
2008. Yes, in my riding. So I can't remember the exact ages, but for example, somebody in average lifespan 63, but in the wealthier riding next door, it'd be like 75.
Jeez.
Or 76, you know. And that's like in this day and age. So you know, I've for many years seen the devastation that poverty brings. And so our platform does a number of things. I mean, people who have low incomes are not able to keep stable housing above their heads, right?
Yep.
And as young people, or as people rather, are trying to, you know, find a new place to live after they've been evicted or the housing is so terrible that they have to try to find a new place to live, it destabilizes the whole family. In one of the schools in my riding, just one of the schools, there is a 150%, 150% turnover of the student body.
Oh my God.
You know what that, in one school year, that means the kids are, that's how much the kids are moving around. Now, how does a child begin to establish an ability to learn and to grasp concepts in elementary school if their family is constantly being destabilized?
Yeah.
So right from that very level, so that's the housing piece. So again, a social determinant of health, stable, adequate, appropriate, quality housing. The social assistance piece, right? I mean, the bottom line is the economy doesn't work for everyone.
That's
and
right.
We do have a lot of people that don't have, that are not able to successfully engage in this economy. So our plan includes increasing the social assistance rates. It should have been done a long time ago, but we are going to tackle that. We shouldn't be punishing people who are low income. We should be giving them a chance to try to you know, build a life, you know, to try to get a toehold to build a life. And so not only will higher income help them to do that, stable housing will help them to do that. Access to their prescription drugs will help them to do that. Making sure that they are able to get their teeth dealt with will do that.
Yep.
I mean, I met a young man recently. The guy was in his teens, in his late teens, when he had an accident. He started working construction to try to make some money. Came from a low-income family. Thought he would take some construction work over a summer. Fell on the job. and broke one of his front teeth, like broke it in half,
yeah.
but couldn't afford to get it fixed. And I met him when he was 29 years old, so 10 years later, and he had just got the tooth fixed. And he told me that that decade, he felt it was the lost decade for him.
Oh, of course.
Because he was embarrassed. Like, he was embarrassed. His social connections eventually started to dwindle away. He didn't have the confidence to, you know, to successfully do job interview. You know, attend job interviews and put himself out there as a, you know, as a competent young man. I mean, his whole life turned around in a negative way because of a broken tooth in the front of his mouth. I mean, these kinds of things will. Like these kinds of programs, like dental care, will positively impact people's lives. You know, I was just in Sudbury, as you know, and I was shocked by the number of people that I spoke to who are, you know, kind of in their early 30s, mid, late 30s, who literally have rotting teeth.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally have rotting teeth. And I talked to this one guy, and he said, I'm 39 years old. He said, I used to have great dental. He said, but I have not been to a dentist in 7 or 8 years. He said, and my teeth are a mess. I have pain in my mouth. He said, I can't get it dealt with. He said, I'm looking forward to a dental plan. You know, I'm looking forward
sure.
to that. I met another young woman. Yeah. I mean, who wouldn't, right?
Well,
another
it's
young woman said,
$180 bucks to get your teeth cleaned and x-rayed and the costs go up.
Right.
Why? Like who has that kind of money if you're trying to pay your hydro bills or buy food to put on your table for your family?
Exactly. I mean, I could tell you just a ton of stories that I hear from people about this, we don't have the time to do that. But
no.
But these are social determinants of health, right? Oral health is important. Oral health can, if you have poor oral health, it can lead to all kinds of other health complications. And so, again, housing, income, you know, dental, access to prescription drugs to stay well, as opposed to, you know, continue to get more and more sick and then end up in emergency. These are all pieces to that puzzle.
A couple more last questions for you, and then I'll let you go because I know you're very, very busy.
Sure.
I do want to make one personal plea, and that's on your investments with mental health. I love it. $2.4 billion, 2,600 new mental health care workers, for supports in high schools. Fantastic. One thing I would encourage you when you're in the premier office is I have a loved one who's battling an acquired brain injury, a anoxic brain injury that she acquired. She's a living miracle. The doctors are always stunned. But we've been through the system a lot in the last few months. And oftentimes what I'm seeing is people with acquired brain injuries are being put into the mental health facilities, and it's depleting resources for those on the mental health side. And there's a lack on the other side. There's a gap to addressing acquired brain injuries and trying to get the proper rehabilitation supports into place. So that's just a bit of a personal plea because it's so important and it's so frustrating to try and navigate that system when we're focusing on mental health care, which we absolutely need to. But part of also the mental health care needs to be these investments in rehabilitation for acquired brain injury patients.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And I can remember doing some work with Bish in Hamilton, the Brain Injury Society of Hamilton, and they do amazing work. So I've actually been exposed to, the unique challenges that people with acquired brain injuries have. And one of the things that's in our platform is also supportive housing.
Right.
So supportive housing where people can, with some supports, live independently. And the supports that wrap around that person are based on what their individual needs are. And so this is something that would help people with acquired brain injury because each person's different, as you know,
yep.
In terms of the kinds of things that they're grappling with their injury. And having a supportive housing would help them to not only have some independence and some dignity, but we would make sure that the supports are there so that they remain safe and they're able to, to undertake the daily parts of living that they're able to, but have supports on the things that they're not quite able to get down.
Good stuff. And you mentioned housing, and I want to just ask one question about that. And that is you're pledging investments in affordable homes, which is fantastic. I sometimes think, though, that we because I'm all for investments in social housing and new and good quality affordable housing. But I sometimes think that we sometimes miss the mark when we talk about affordable housing because some people can't even afford to get into the housing market, period. And it's not because they're on, they need or they're on social assistance or they're low income, but they just can't afford to get in. So How do you help affordable housing expand that definition a little bit to middle class families that can't get a shake in the Toronto area, for example?
No, well, you've hit on a very important issue, because especially in Toronto, I mean, the Toronto Board of Trade has identified that some 42% of young people are leaving the city because they can't afford to live there. I mean, there are people that were raised in Toronto who have no hope of buying into the neighborhood that they were raised in. So there's a couple of pieces around that. I mean, one is we have concerns around people who don't live in Ontario but own property in Ontario.
Yep.
Those are the places that are often, you know, flipped. That reduces the likelihood of people who need that housing to be able to access it. I mean, the other thing is there's something called the missing middle when it comes to housing in the Toronto area. There's all kinds of high-rise condos, and there's there are many historic neighborhoods with single-family homes.
Yep.
But the kind of the mid-rise model that is more conducive to families and much more affordable needs to be added to the market, and I mean the private market. And so we need to work with the development community, the developer community, particularly along transit lines, to do some of that infill work, to find ways to encourage those folks to build that kind of housing, because it will be more affordable, and I mean that in terms of for home buyers, for middle-class home buyers, and it also will help young people to stay in Toronto and not have to leave and spend hours on the road to drive into work. That's one piece. I mean, there are a number of other things, I'm sure, as you know, in the platform around housing.
So, listen, you are busy. I know I need to let you go, but I have to ask you, formative political moment for you and favorite and most inspiring politician. What are those two things? What keeps you going and what's inspired you to go this far?
Okay, so this is a funny one. So formative political moment, like really political moment, was when I started university and I was in commerce. I was in commerce at McMaster business course, and I, as I'm listening to the professors, I'm listening to them talk about working people as an input cost. Do you know
right.
what I mean? Like
yep.
they were an input cost to a company, and I couldn't get over it. I couldn't get over the people being called input costs, and so I realized then that was not the program for me. And then I switched to labor studies, where the perspective was completely the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
so that's part of it. I mean, I'm sure there were many, many other things over the years, but I do remember that as a funny time. But look, I mean, I grew up in a family that was working class, and so I was exposed to to the labor movement. I remember when my dad would come home with his UAW at the time, right? It wasn't even yep. Unifor or CAW, it was UAW. His leaflets from the plant or his union bulletins, and I would read them because I was curious. I can remember times when they were in negotiations and there was tension in the household because, my dad wasn't sure whether they were going to go on strike or not. I can remember those times. I mean, we talked about that stuff around the kitchen table and what it would mean to our family should my dad be on strike. So there's lots of pieces that make up a person, right?
That's right.
And some of those I can recall. When it comes to a political figure, I sometimes think about Agnes MacPhail, who was
yes.
woman, one of the first women in the legislature. But, when I think about what moved me, what moves me the most in terms of politics, I think about immigrant women in Hamilton. I mean, I started doing English as a second language and literacy work coming out of university at a time when there was a recession in the province, and lots of workers had gone to the factories in the good old days. You didn't even have to put in an application.
No.
I mean, you got hired at the plant gate. They were sucking people in. The economy was booming so much, right? And then recession hits, and 20 years later, and these mostly guys, right, in the industrial heartland of Hamilton, had no English skills, or even if they were English as their first language, they couldn't read and write. They were in the factory floor, and they could make a living there. So we did a lot of work with English as a second language and literacy to try to help people transition in a really bad economy. And particularly the immigrant women that I met, who came to Canada with their husbands and their kids, and many of them never did learn English. I mean, because their husbands were the ones that went out and learned English and made their way in the world for their families. But they were in this strange, community, a strange country, and worked day in and day out to make sure that their family was able to make a go of it, and that their kids were able to, you know, to get to school and begin to get educated and, you know, get into the healthcare system. And I mean, those people are my heroes. I can't imagine some of the, you know, some of the things that people have experienced in their home countries that have come as refugees, for example, or even people that choose to immigrate from, you know, from other countries and don't have the language. I mean, those are the people that are my heroes, because it, for me, I can't imagine what they overcome to be then successful and then become such important, you know, parts of our vibrant communities. I find it pretty amazing, to be honest with you.
Well, Andrea, I can't thank you enough. I hope you'll come back. And I hope when you do come back, I can call you Premier, because you're 6 points back was the last poll I saw. Margin of error. That's a tied game as far as I'm concerned. The wind's at your back. And I've already got my sign for John Hansen in Kanata Carlton. He's a great candidate. But I can't thank you enough. There's so many progressives that want to stop Doug Ford. And I urge you, get behind this wonderful, wonderful leader and her party and her platform. So thanks so much, Andrea.
My pleasure, Cameron. Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
That was my interview with Andrea Horvath. Again, Andrea, thank you so much. I can't wait for the next time I talk with you, because then it's going to be Premier Horvath. June the 7th, folks, it's the election. We're going to be talking about it on the pod, obviously, a lot between now and then. I am fully endorsing the Ontario NDP. I would love very much if my listeners across the province, we have tons of listeners in southwestern Ontario, tons of listeners in Ottawa, in Toronto, in areas where it can really make a difference. I am asking you to give your vote to Andrea Horvath and the Ontario NDP. You can learn more about their platform at OntarioNDP.ca. I also encourage you to do what I did last night, and that is send them a little bit of money too, because those small donations really make a difference. And this is truly a grassroots campaign, a working class campaign that'll get this province back on track. Andrea, thank you so much. Go kick some ass. And anybody but Ford, folks, Andrea is your answer.